What's up, everybody? Thanks again for tuning in to another episode of the Car Tech Garage, where we go over just one more week in automotive history.
Yeah.
What's up, Max?
You know, just trying to keep some cars interesting.
Here we go.
That's what we do.
Yep. I went to a car meet last night and, you know, kind of got talking to a couple of people, you know, just talking about cars. And I was actually, you know, pretty astounded at the response. Like, you know, when I was, they asked me, you know, what I was doing and everything, a couple of friends of mine, and, you know, we were just talking about the Car Tech Garage and how we've been just talking about cars this whole year and years prior on the radio show. And it's just really nice because, you know, people start to respect that a little bit and they come to you with their questions. And, you know, being able to help people with the knowledge that we have and the knowledge that we've gained is really why we do this. You know, I mean, I don't want to keep all this stuff all to myself. I want to tell it to you guys.
So, you know, that's the biggest part about it is, you know, we love bringing this information to you guys. And, you know, we're both professionals in the automotive industry. So we see a lot, you know, as far as the maintenance side goes and used vehicles. And we're just in general car nerds, as I like to call it.
Exactly. But I'm astounded by you know, the feedback from people. So thanks, everybody that is listening to the Car Tech Garage. We can't thank you enough. It's such a pleasure just to be able to present this stuff to you guys every single week.
Yeah, and, you know, I also want to, you know, thank you guys, too, because I think we reached 1,000 downloads on the podcast. So I know we've only been doing this a short while, and that's not a huge number. But seriously, thank you guys for listening and, you know, downloading our podcast, rating it, and also checking us out on, you know, Facebook, Instagram, and I think we're on TikTok too. So we do some videos from time to time, trying to make some fun stuff as far as cars go. But yeah, just huge shout out. Thank you guys.
Yeah, you guys are the best. So let's go ahead, buckle up and take a ride through this week in automotive history. May 30th, 1911, 110 years ago, the very first Indianapolis 500 was ran. Now, the winner was only averaging about 75 miles an hour during this, but, you know, you got to think about the time that this was, 1911. So the guy that won, his name was Ray Haroun, H-A-R-R-O-U-N, and he was driving this car called the Marmon Wasp. Now, I've seen the Marmon Wasp in person. It's actually at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway History Museum. In their main lobby area. And it's basically a ladder frame with wheels and like this, you know, doghouse over top of it. It's very rudimentary. But, you know, that was the very first car that had won it in 1911. You know, race cars really weren't even a thought yet. They usually took these big, you know, luxury car chassis and engines. And that way they, you know, just stripped them down as light as they could go and they'd run those. The Indy 500 was really initially the creation of this guy named Carl Fisher. He had purchased the track, and in the fall of 1909, he replaced this, you know, ruined, they used to have like crushed stone and tar on the track, and he ended up repaving it with a 2.5 mile oval, brand new brick all the way around. It was at the time the largest paved bank oval in the United States by far, and they laid this, they called it the golden brick. They laid the golden brick down right at the finish line to kind of solidify the, you know, finishing of the track. Now, the gold brick only laid there for about 2 weeks before somebody, you know, jacked it. Yeah, they stole that. So what they do now is they've actually remade it. It was just a big bronze one that was painted gold. And what they do now is they place it there and then they take it back to a safe facility after each race. But the first one, if that thing ever surfaces, it's going to be worth so much money.
Oh, it has to be, you know, that's why it's called the Brickyard.
Exactly. And, you know, by the second year of the Indy 500, 1912, it had actually become the highest paying single day sporting event in the entire world. I mean, manufacturers and racers from the world over knew that winning or even being seen at the Indy 500 would mean millions in free advertising. I mean, it's a simple formula by today's standards, but, you know, back in that time, the risk of putting so much money down was really rarely taken. This was 1911. You didn't gamble at all.
It blows my mind that, you know, like advertising, that wasn't a thought process yet where they're just like, wait, a bunch of people come to this race. If we put some like signs or, you know, create some sales, like people are going to buy more of our product and be interested. That's crazy. Let's do it. You know, it's too funny to think about. That wasn't a thing yet.
Yeah. And that hadn't even been thought of. But again, you know, the cars back in these days were really neat and also terrifying. I mean, huge 4-cylinder engines. And, you know, they basically took off these big luxury bodies and left the frames and put on these little doghouse bodies that basically just covered the engine and a little bit of a cockpit. The floorboards were actually wooden floorboards. The wheels at the time, keep in mind, these were still wooden wheels. They typically made them out of ash, you know, because they were stronger. The seats were generally just metal buckets that were bolted to those floorboards. And, you know, they only had rear drum brakes. That's it. Just rear drum brakes. That's the only brakes they had. Now, here's the crazy part about racing in the early 1910s. The engines were terrible, frankly. I mean, they didn't fit together very well. They didn't seal anything out. They didn't have like these proper oil sump systems to properly distribute oil. So these cars would dump gallons of oil. Even the best made cars would dump nearly a dozen gallons of oil all over the racetrack over the course of the 500-mile event. So keep in mind, jeez, these cars traveling at nearly 80 miles an hour on a brick track covered in oil with zero suspension and wooden wheels. You talk about some grapefruits.
Yeah. Well, it's like a hold my beer kind of moment.
Oh,
right,
my
there.
Gosh. Yeah. So like, I'm surprised this race wasn't held in Kentucky, but geez.
Yeah.
So only a decade later in 1922, you know, they got smarter and they started making cars faster. And not necessarily faster, but more controllable. So like nearly all the cars that started like in 1922, 23 were purpose-built race cars. They had more aerodynamic bodies, you know, like the narrower grills and the teardrop-shaped tails. Mm-hmm. They had the knockoff wire wheels with the center lock spline, you know, to make for quicker tire changes, newer tires, you know, and they were actually fitted with four-wheel hydraulic brakes, you know, inline and V8 engines that were actually made of aluminum, like Miller.
Yeah.
Harry Miller's cars, you know, used aluminum engines and like an aluminum supercharged four-cylinder in his, you know, Miller Golden Submarine. But they were, you know, smaller, lighter, more efficient, and of course, far more expensive. In the mid-1920s, Miller and Duesenberg were probably the premier race cars. Duesenberg straight eight, mm-hmm. Miller's cars were, you know, on another level in terms of their technological advancement. I mean, there was even stories of Miller's cars in the 30s and 40s still running up with a pack just because the fuel quality had gotten better.
Yeah, remember, we talked about this.
Yeah.
That's, you know, impressive in itself.
It really is to make something that can, you know, transcend through time and stay relevant. Kind of like
better than it actually is at that given time.
Yeah, it was like the Converse All-Star of cars. Yeah. Like, why are they still around? Why are people still wearing them?
Won't they go away?
They
like
won't.
It's like the Volkswagen Beetle.
Gosh, like, why are they still cool? Yeah,
exactly.
Anyway. So May 31st, 1965, moving ahead a little bit here, 56 years ago, Jim Clark. Oh, yeah, we love Jim Clark around here. He won the Indianapolis 500 in his Lotus. Now, 65, average speed was about 150 miles an hour. The cool part is Jim Clark, of course, an amazing racer in his own right, you know, a multiple-time world championship winner in F1. He actually skipped the Monaco Grand Prix this day to race at the Indianapolis 500 because he was already ahead in points and he currently held the points record for F1. So he's the only driver in history to win the Formula One World Championship and the Indy 500 in the same year. And that was with him skipping a race.
That's crazy.
That's awesome. Jim Clark was a beast. All right, moving ahead again, June 1st, 1981. The production of Corvettes began at the new Bowling Green plant in Kentucky, and the facility has remained the exclusive home of the fiberglass American supercar ever since. Corvette is the world's longest running continuously produced passenger car, which actually surprised me. I thought I had recognized that from somewhere, but that's still pretty impressive nonetheless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Question then.
I like how they call it a passenger car. You got one passenger.
I mean, yeah, it's still technically a passenger.
So taking it way back, 1953, the first year of the Corvette, the first 300 were actually all built by hand in Flint, Michigan. The following year, they moved to St. Louis, and all the way up until 81, they were produced in St. Louis until they moved it up to Bowling Green. The facility that they make them in, I've been there before, it actually used to be a Chrysler air conditioning manufacturing facility.
Really?
And they totally revamped it, made the building bigger and all that stuff. But yeah, the Corvettes have been built in Bowling Green ever since 1981, every single one of them.
It's kind of neat, you know.
Yeah, definitely worth going to. Going to see the National Corvette Museum, where they had the sinkhole and everything. That is definitely worth visiting. It only takes about an hour to walk through and maybe an hour and a half if you really want to read everything. They've got a gift shop. It's a ton of fun. We should probably head down there.
Yeah. yep. soon, sometime.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's only like a 3-hour drive from us in Cincinnati.
Oh, okay, it's not that bad at all.
Yeah, no, not that bad at all. I don't know if my Camry will make it, but we'll find a way to get down there.
We might be walking.
All right, June 2nd, 1936. This one's super interesting, and not a lot of people know about it. 85 years ago, the American Bantam Car Company was incorporated. Now, American Bantam doesn't have the most storied history. If anybody is a big fan of the Jeep, like the original military Jeep, you'll know about the American Bantam Car Company. So this guy named Roy S. Evans, Roy Evans was the president of it, and it was initially formed in 1929 as that same holder under the American Austin Car Company. Austin was, of course, a manufacturer over in Europe. And then it got reorganized in 1936 because they actually filed for bankruptcy. So after a little while, they started making like cheap European cars, British cars to bring them over to the U.S. Now, it had an opportunity for growth in the late 1930s, and that came with the competition for the development of a new quarter-ton four-wheel drive vehicle for the U.S. Army. And I'm sure we all know what ended up coming of that. So the American Bantam Company actually laid out the design and groundwork for this Jeep, this new Jeep. Now, it wasn't actually called the Jeep. It was actually just called the general purpose vehicle, the military general purpose vehicle. And there's a couple of different stories as to how it got the name Jeep. Some people think that general purpose got shortened to GP and people just started calling it Jeep. And there's another story from the old Popeye Sailor cartoons, like the comic strips. He had this dog thing that ran around with him sometimes, and it was called the Jeep. And the Jeep had like extraordinary strength, and it was like, you know, basically unkillable, kind of like Popeye was after he ate his spinach. And a lot of people think that that's where this Jeep name came from, because there's nothing that could stop this little thing from getting wherever it needed to go. Now, unfortunately, they did not end up getting the contract because of the limited facilities that they had. The U.S. Army needed a production capacity of at least 75 a day before World War II began, and they just couldn't keep up with that type of volume. So, unfortunately for the American Bantam Car Company, the U.S. military ended up giving the high-volume contracts to Ford and Willys Overland Company. Yep. So you hear the Willys Jeep, Ford Jeep, they both produced tons of them. And American Bantam, you know, basically is remembered just for having designed the mainstay of it.
That's what's funny is that you bring that up, because I had somebody ask me a couple weeks ago, like, what is Jeep derived from? And I started looking into it, and I was like, there's really no good answer. There's not one story. There's no one reason why it's called Jeep. And
nobody yet knows.
Everybody's obsessed with them.
Yep. Nobody knows. It's a Jeep thing.
Yep. Exactly.
That's the only answer you can get, right?
It's such a terrible answer. Oh, I love God. Using it.
Why is it broken? Well,
it's a Jeep. Not like they used to.
Oh, no, not quite. That's still cool. I wouldn't mind driving around Gladiator. I don't love them, but I can't hate it, because I would drive one.
They only look good to me in a Rubicon like stock configuration.
Yeah, like with the black bigger gray. Tires. Even the white ones look pretty good. I just think the white with the black top is kind of ugly.
Just the sport, like the base model. It just...
Yeah, it doesn't... It's kind of like buying like a base two-door Jeep.
Looks
it
like
just,
a...
It doesn't
mail
look
truck.
Like a Jeep.
Yeah, it's
does
a mail
look,
you're truck.
Right. It does look like a mail truck.
It doesn't look like it goes off-road. It just delivers your mail, and, you know, they put the steering wheel on the other side so they can drop it in your mailbox.
You're not going to get anywhere with those road tires, buddy.
Yeah, no. But yeah, Rubicon, it's like, okay.
That's the thing. I mean, if you think about it, you get a Jeep, a pickup truck, and a convertible, essentially, all in one.
I know. That's what I was that's exactly what I was thinking the
all
other day.
All for a cool $60,000.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Where you could buy a Miata, you could buy a Silverado, and you could buy, something else.
I know. I was looking at them the other day. I'm like, hey, let's see if there's any used Gladiators on the market. You know, maybe I could find one.
Oh, they're still sky
high. Oh, yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, everybody wants 30 or 40 for them. You might be able to find a few under 30, God, but...
40 to 45.
Yeah, it's yeah.
I would only get the Rubicon, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. It's what you, I'd make fun of you. I'd make fun of you if you got a base model, for sure. All right, moving ahead. June 3rd, 1973. Jackie Stewart, the Flying Scot, won the Monaco Grand Prix driving a Tyrrell. This was the day he equaled the record of his friend Jim Clark with 25 Grand Prix victories. And another fun fact, in this race in 1973, it was actually the very first race that James Hunt raced in, who would become future world champion.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And the Tyrrell was awesome. It was like that blue one that had the ELF, ELF livery on it, number 5. Really, really cool car. Tyrrell made some really sweet cars back in the 70s, man. They really did.
It just looks so neat. I would love to have one of those now.
Oh, duh.
Go-kart and steroids.
Yes, exactly. That's what we love about F1 racing. There we are. Just
go-karts on steroids. major steroids.
Exactly.
I go to the gym 7 times a day.
Yeah, I would say go-karts, go-karts from Krypton. That's what it is. All right, June 4th, 1970. I know we're kind of picking up a little bit here, but 43 years ago, Mario Andretti won the Spanish Grand Prix in a Lotus 79. He took it from pole position. Now, he got pole position, but he got passed by James Hunt right off the start. He led in the first corner, and Hunt actually led for 7 laps before Andretti finally, in his Lotus 79, passed him and pulled away. It ended up being a 1-2 Lotus with Andretti and Peterson winning. Lotus 79 was an awesome, awesome car, too. Like, every single Lotus ever made in that black John Player special livery just has my heart. It doesn't matter which Lotus it is, you know, whether it was Andretti, whether it was Ayrton driving it, that setup is perfect.
It is.
I love that livery. All right, and this one is for you, Max. June 4th, 1996. We were both alive then. Yeah. 25 years ago. Colin McRae, you know him, and yes, Derek Ringer won the Acropolis Rally in a Subaru Impreza. Yeah.
Back when Subaru was dominant.
Burble Roo. There we go.
Burble Roo.
Now, the first Acropolis Rally was actually held back in 1951, and it holds stages all over the roughest terrain in Greece. Even the fabled Mount Olympus, which is the highest mountain in Greece.
Yes.
Yep. So you actually get to drive up Mount Olympus. I mean, that's awesome. Like, if you're going to win one rally, you want it to be the Acropolis Rally. actually, because the lineup in this was stiff, too. Carlos Sainz came in third with his teammate, and second in a Mitsubishi Lancer Evo was Mäkinen Tomi, or Tomi Mäkinen. I can never remember which one comes first with the too. Swedes. So sorry for anybody that's listening in Sweden. I'm not too well versed. But anyway, you guys are amazing rally drivers. Just a heads up. Yeah, so it went a Subaru Mitsubishi Ford 1-2-3 on that race. All right, now the last one up here for this week, June 5th, 1960. Again, about Jim Clark. 60 years ago, he made his Formula One debut driving for Lotus. He commonly drove for Lotus in the Dutch Grand Prix. Now, Clark, who won 2 world championships, 63 and 65, was noted as one of the most versatile drivers ever. He competed in sports cars, touring cars, and the Indy 500, just like we said. Of course, he won in 1965. And, of course, he was particularly associated with this Lotus marquee. You know, him and Colin Chapman just ran through everybody. Now, unfortunately, he lost his life when he was killed in a Formula 2 motor racing accident in Hockenheim at a Formula 2 event during practice. That was in 68. But at the time of his death, and he was pretty young, he had won more Grand Prix races, which were 25, achieved more Grand Prix pole positions at 33 than any other driver. And even in 2009, the Times placed this big article about, you know, the greatest ever Formula One drivers, and they noted Clark at the very top of the list. People would often ask him, you know, Jim, why are you so much faster than everyone else? And he couldn't really give an answer. He would basically say, I don't know. I just have a good feeling for the car, a good feeling for the limit. Just like Schumacher always says, yep. I've got a really good feeling for the limit. And it obviously is on full display during him driving a car, and we may not even notice how good he's really doing because it's all above our grade.
Yeah. It's, you know, you just see a big car going fast.
Yeah.
That's it.
Not to promote another channel here without having an affiliation with him, but there's this YouTube channel called Driver 61.
Yep.
He does a fantastic job cataloging all of this different stuff. He's a professional driver himself, and he actually shows the onboard car data, like steering input, throttle input from these F1 races, and explains what's going on, because he is a pro driver. He's been in Formula cars before, and he's showing all these different graphs of how everybody steers in, puts throttle acceleration, and drivers like Schumacher, when you look at the graphs, it looks like they're being more erratic and less smooth. But the fact of the matter is they're at the limit so frequently that they're constantly making micro corrections.
Yep.
And it looks like they're jostling the wheel around when really they're just twinging it with their fingers so perfectly that it's like second nature to them. It's not even anything that somebody could react to. You have to be proactive with it in the best way.
We got to think they're making judgments going, you know, above 100 miles an hour through turns. And basically at 100 miles an hour, you think of 100 feet ahead of you. In that small amount of time, like, you're there.
Yeah,
you're 100 feet further.
If you have to think about the turn, it's already too late, because by the time you thought about it, you're past that turn, hopefully. I mean, that's how it is, and especially when you're driving that fast. Yeah. Well, I think that's all we've got for this week. Thanks everybody for tuning in again. We're going to be back, of course, next week with another week in automotive history, and make sure you check out this week's coming podcast. We're going to have a podcast coming up about Phil Hill. Phil Hill's a great driver too. He unfortunately passed away in 08, but he's the only American-born F1 driver ever to win a world championship. So make sure you guys check that out.